This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Hi, this is Deborah here. Thank you so much for downloading this podcast. We just wanted to make you aware that Rachel knew and wanted us to release this final podcast that we recorded. When we recorded it, we didn't know at the time that this would be the final time that we would be together. However, it is her explicit wishes that not only do we air it, that we continue with it. So we hope that you enjoy.
Deb's bid for Strictly producers, if you're watching. They might have cast this year. If you need a standby, Deb's looks great in sequins, wears a lot of them. She poses like a pro, so she must be able to dance like a pro.
Basically, I just want the outfit.
Yes. You do. I could just imagine you being like, la-da.
Hello and welcome to You, Me and the Big C with Lauren Marn, a.k.a. Girl vs. Cancer.
Hey, y'all.
Deborah James, better known to some as Bow Babe.
Hey, yeah.
And me, Rachel Bland from Big C Little Me, also heard on 5 Live. We are three friends. We are all bloggers. We have one thing in common. Well, loads of things in common, but there's one thing. We all have or we have had cancer. And we want to tell you about the highs as well as the lows. Get in touch with us to suggest future topics you want to hear us talk about. Let us know your experiences. Give us all your feedback, please. Use the hashtag YouMeBigC across all forms of social media. And before we get into all this as well, I think it was a good moment to reflect on the amazing reaction that we've had to Series 2 so far.
No, thank you.
Yeah, it's been great, isn't it?
Yeah, thank
really
you to everybody that's got in touch. You know, thank you to BBC Breakfast for having us on, BBC 5 Live Breakfast. You know, we've got to have some wonderful chats and, you know, the film that they put together on BBC Breakfast, it was amazing.
We were staying up here and we were watching it in the hotel room, myself and Loz, and we just bawled our eyes out.
Oh my God, it's us.
And all our comments have been amazing. Yeah. So thank you. We've all received direct comments and on Twitter.
Yeah,
and
across social media has been just terrific. So thank you so much for listening, for commenting, for giving us your feedback, because it's been lovely to hear it all, and for spreading the word, because I feel like we've got a lot of new listeners in the family.
Welcome, Big C family.
Well, so welcome along if you've just started listening.
Have put us up to the top of the charts. So
yay!
I think we really appreciate that.
We very much appreciate that. So we've got our highest top position. Not that we're competitive.
Yeah,
ladies,
I know.
At all.
We're terrible. We're obsessed with that chart. So thank you for sticking us up near the top of the iTunes chart. It's just been an amazing, amazing response. So I hope we can live up to the hype for the rest of Series 2. Today we're going to talk about a term that we all kept hearing through our treatment, and that is new normal, and what that now means to us. We're also going to speak to consultant breast surgeon Liz O'Riordan, who's been having treatment for breast cancer herself. So is in a really unique position, I think, to talk to us about this. So girls, let's just explain this, because it's a phrase that we've all heard through our treatment. What do we mean by new normal?
I think I first heard it, did you girls, like with my nurses and stuff?
So
like,
yeah, mine was from my chemo nurse.
Yeah, I think it was like quite early on, and I'd be like, oh, what about this? Or like, what about that? I'd be questioning, oh, what about back at work? Or, oh no, like all my friends are going out and like they're drinking and I can't go and blah. And they were like, well, you'll soon settle into your new normal. And it's something you start to hear all the time. This is your new normal. You'll accept your new normal. And it's basically life after diagnosis.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily mean like cancer-free. It just means that your life, your what you would term as normal for you, has changed forever.
Yeah.
And it is part of the battle, I think, the mental battle at the beginning, don't you think?
Yeah, because for me it kind of meant, you know, I would never have that innocent life again where you can just carry on and, you know, book holidays years in advance and, you know, think about future plans without having to think, oh, I've got a hospital appointment there. You know, what's going to happen when I have that scan? Even if I'd got through the first lot of treatment and it had gone, you know, like you did, it's always still there. You're going to be going to hospital for the rest of your life.
Yeah. I mean, I know we're going to delve into this later on in the pod, but I have my new normal is, I can't even remember what my old normal was like. Yeah. I've gone from somebody who used to have her entire diary planned a year in advance.
Wow.
Because I was a teacher, and in teaching, you generally have a timetable that's pretty much pinned down for the year. You do your diary planning in July that will take you up all the way to the following July. So I could pretty much tell you on, you know, in April 2019 what I was supposed to be doing,
where I was supposed to be,
and obviously, you know, there was fluidity with it. However, you know, everything was in the future, and I've worked in that scenario for 14 years. Mm. So imagine now, I am petrified. I don't know about you, but I can't plan a week in advance.
Yeah, it's that fear of not knowing what's coming.
Yeah, and when I, you know, I have to admit I'm not overly organised. However, you know, when you have these over-organized people like you, Loza.
I try.
Who's like, what are you doing? What are you doing for New Year 2019? And I'm like, I don't know. I'm hoping I'm alive.
You know, I definitely, like, I was always someone who think, oh, one day when, or when I get married, or when I have kids, or when I buy a house, or I would like to do this in the future. I don't think like that now. It's literally months ahead. Yeah. So like before, I'd be thinking, oh, next summer I could do this. When actually, I'm like, actually in January, I'm clear. But I've kind of almost retrained my brain to live for the now and do things in the immediate future, like the next few months that make me happy. So I just plan for like, I'm like thinking now about Christmas, New Year. I'm not thinking beyond that.
Yeah. I mean, it makes me sad that when Steve and I met, we used to have these like sweet little conversations about when we grow old, we're going to sit there and we'll be 70 years old, sat on a bench by the coast, eating our fish and chips together. And that was something that was always there to look forward to. But the new normal kind of took that away.
Yeah.
And you weren't able to have those conversations and those innocent kind of thoughts and you know, looking that far into the future.
It is that loss of innocence, isn't it? It's like once you're in, there's no going back. There's never again going to be a cough or a cold or a pain or a lump or anything that you have that you're not going to be a bit like,
But you know, when cancer enters your life, there's very few moments where you feel that innocence or that freedom if you were living with, say, a stage four diagnosis or maybe even in the shadow of cancer.
Yeah.
So for me, running, funny enough, is the only time in my life that I ever feel free because all I can focus on for that moment is whether I'm going to make it through the 5K or the 10K, however slowly.
Does that kind of clear your mind?
It clears my mind.
Yeah, because I find that with swimming does that best for me. Running, I still think, but swimming is that repetitive counting the laps. That's the only thing that will clear my brain.
You know that feeling? And it's quite funny because I was experiencing this the other day. All I crave is that that idea that you can walk out your front door and be free and kind of do whatever you want. Like, forget that you have kids and responsibilities. but let's park that for the moment. And you know that freedom of kind of I can do anything I want in my life.
Yeah.
Now, I can, but then I've probably got to come back for a hospital appointment in 2 days' time, and a scan might tell me that I might not be here at Christmas or whatever it might be. And all I crave is that innocence.
The possibilities that are endless. But you know what? In a funny way, like, we've all talked about this quite openly, in that being so close to our death, we now live fuller.
Yeah.
And more like lives that we want are happy in for now. Do you know what I mean? Like, you've just said, it would be so nice to step out that door and be like, oh, infinite possibilities. But before I had cancer, I didn't really think like that.
Yeah.
Because I just leave my house, but I've got to go work today and this and that. Yeah, now I don't have bad Mondays because Monday's another day I'm alive. I'm here. I've got a whole day to fill. And that mindset shift was the big, big thing for me, because beforehand, we're all guilty of it. It's not a bad thing. We are human. But we all walk around with like a cape of invisibility on us that like we're forever. We're fine. We've got this. And I wrote about it in my first ever blog post. I said, it's like, you know, Madonna at the Brits where the cape gets ripped from you. That is literally what it's like, isn't it?
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you're like, okay, I'm not invincible.
Yeah. You've fallen down those steps backwards.
You've fallen down the steps backwards and onto your bum very hard, and it must have hurt. But what it's done for me is now, like I said, I don't think too far into the future. I think about what makes me happy, and I make decisions on the now, not tomorrow, Lauren.
Yeah.
Because I used to make decisions on, oh, but in the future, where now I'm like, well, actually, that will make me happy in the next couple of months.
That's exactly what I did. I would say that I was just living kind of in my head a bit and in the future of, oh, well, maybe I'll get to do this and, you know, maybe I'll do that with my career and we'll do this with Freddie and, you know, when we have another child, we'll do that. But it was always like forward planning, my kind of future planning head. And yeah, on the day to day kind of stuff, I wouldn't be living it as well. And, you know, I would sweat the small stuff. I'd be bothered by, you know, money, you know, whether Freddie was developing in the right way, you know, whether work was going well. And yeah, I guess one of the few positives that you could take out of it is that, yeah, I don't worry about that stuff anymore. But don't sweat the small stuff.
Do you guys, like Lauren and Emrich, do you miss that? Because I do. I miss not being able to daydream and plan for a future.
Yeah.
What about you, Lauren?
I do miss that. But at the same time, Lauren pre-cancer was so scared of dying. We've talked about this before. My health anxiety, as much as I daydream about a future, I'd also over-analyse and worry about my demise, about what was going to be the thing to kill me.
Yeah.
And I'd spend a lot of energy. It wasn't like as bad as it is with cancer, but like I'd always worry. I was a bit ill. I was terrible for panic attacks.
Yeah.
So in some respects, yes, 100%. I would never have had cancer and be that person, because we all know this is not a club you want to be part of.
Yeah.
We're just making it work. But now I'm like, actually, I feel like I am living my life. I'm present. That's the word.
You're present.
I'm present. I don't think I was present in my life. I was just going. I was a hamster wheel.
You've used the phrase before, comfortably numb.
Comfortably numb.
I relate to that. I was comfortably numb. I was striving. I was training to be a head teacher. And all I ever really focused on was training to be a head teacher. I'm still passionate about education, but that's all I really thought about. And I would say I was so, you know, I was working at 3 o'clock in the morning. All I wanted to do was kind of achieve that. I don't know what I was then going to do after it, apart from
set yourself another goal, because you would have done.
Absolutely. And I was very blinkered in terms of where I wanted to go. And it's amazing how the one thing that you were working towards for 14 years or whatever it is whipped away from you.
Yeah.
And then you have to start again. Like, what do you do? You have to, well, if you want to continue in a career, I built a whole different career as a result.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think, you know, loads of us have gone down different routes. I don't think it's just the mental thing, though. For me, it's coping with the body.
Yeah, my new normal body.
Yeah.
And don't you find that it's the anxiety, right? Right, this is where my anxiety kicks in, because whenever you talk about cancer and early detection of cancers and stuff, it's like, know what's normal for your body. Once you've had cancer, you don't know what your normal is anymore.
It just goes,
it changes
crazy,
all the time.
Yeah.
And I don't, we're still such, I'm a really early phase recovery. Obviously, you girls have things changing all the time. So, like, when would it settle? When would you know what's normal?
Yeah, I think I talked about this last week. I can't remember whether we did it on air or off air. But when I get scared is when I get a new type of pain that I have felt before. And I know this is not a familiar pain. You know, this is not a headache that I felt before, or this is not a nerve pain that I've had before. Mm. And that's what makes me really suspicious, because, you know, if I've not had the pain before, then it's probably something related to the cancer.
I'm just going to be really honest with our listeners. So before we went on air, I was pretty much having a panic attack, wasn't I?
Yeah.
And for no reason, other than we've had an emotional couple of days, I think. I don't know. I've got procedure coming up. Yeah. You know, when you just...
Yeah, it gets on top of you.
It gets on top of you. And I just don't know. And you know, it's that feeling where you feel a little bit on edge.
It's that thing, like, to look at you, you wouldn't notice, but your shoulders are slightly raised.
Your toes are curled. Absolutely. Yeah. I felt a bit dizzy. I was kind of hyperventilating. So Rach has this thing to monitor.
Yeah, it's an oxygen sats probe.
It's what they put in your finger in A&E if you don't go in.
But now I'm a bit obsessed. I'm hypervigilant, which I think is quite a common thing.
It's really funny. So I've been using it because my sats go low because of this chest infection. So I had my I had my oxygen bottle earlier just to get some oxygen after being doing a lot of launch and stuff with the podcast today. And my sats had gone right down to about 80. Shh, don't tell him at the hospital. But Deb's, hers are like 98, 99, 100.
Because I'm hyperventilating.
But now she's worrying that they're too high.
Yeah. But
it's really at one end of the scale and you at the other.
No, but this is the problem. And you suddenly become absolutely obsessed I've become obsessed with taking my temperature all the time.
Yeah.
And my health anxiety just is manifesting itself in another way. And however, that becomes a new normal for me. So my lungs being a bit dodgy and understanding that I just have slightly dodgy lungs, that means, you know, I start wheezing at every occasion.
Oh, that's Rachel's line.
Hey, I'm which Rachel. Is
you're wheezy.
Dizzy.
I'm dizzy. Okay, I'm fine. Dizzy. I start getting dizzy. I can't walk in heels. Okay, let's just go back to basics. Basically, I can't walk in heels anymore. And as a result, it becomes really, you know, that is my new normal that I have to buy a whole new...
oxygen sets.
Are you taking... Carry on, everyone. Quite good. No, my new normal is now I have to have a new wardrobe with, like, you know, supportive boots instead.
Yeah.
Well, my issue now, you know, my new normal is that I'm too scared to buy clothes because I think, well, if I'm not going to be around for very long.
Oh, you're saying,
oh, right, we're in the 90s. Don't
we're
panic,
okay.
everyone.
No oxygen
heart rate
needed.
Is good. Yeah, we're all fine. The bottle can stay in the bag. Yeah, at the moment, I've got this thing where I'm kind of, you know, I love shopping. You know, I love shopping and buying things. That's what's got me through all the cancer treatment. And at the moment, I feel like I won't get cost per wear.
Yeah.
So I did buy myself a really expensive new handbag the other day because I was kind of like, oh, it's a backpack. It'll help me carry things better. But now I'm just like, yeah, if I'm, you know, my husband said, oh, get a nice pair of shoes, get some Jimmy Choos. I'm like, really? They're just wasted on me now. You know, I'll wear them once, put them in the box and then, you know,
yeah, but maybe you could wear them once, wear them in the box.
Yeah. But see, they'd normally...
And you have a really nice outfit.
I was normally, just thinking I'd if we're the same size, I'll have them if you carry.
Yeah.
Normally, that's the kind of thing, you know, shoes, you can stick them in the box in the cupboard for years and you can still come back to them. And now I can't have that. So
don't worry. I'm sure there's lots of people that would take them. My daughter says, as callous as this is, it makes me laugh. I always say to my daughter, are you worried about mummy dying? And her response now, because it's so blasé in my family, is, well, mummy, if you die, can I have your shoes and your clothes?
I just think that's
she's
quite
so
sweet.
She's one of us.
I bequeath them to you.
She has a dark sense of humour, doesn't she? My new normal is just my, you know, because I've had operations around my bowel and my bladder, I'm kind of jiggling around sitting here on site because my bladder and my bowel, you know, just this obsessive, relentless weakness that is almost my new normal. So whether that is kind of urgency, like if I rush out of here,
legs
100 miles an hour.
I think it's like the now though, isn't it? That's what it is with us. It's like, I don't know, like my new normal, my body, I'm in menopause now. Mm. So that's a massive shift. Mm. You know, like I just want to go to sleep and not wake up sweating like six times in the night. But it's so weird how within 6 months, that's now my new normal. And I'm so used to it. And I've adapted my life, my pyjamas, my bedding, fans. Like
it requires a lot of buying of stuff.
There's a lot
Everything
of buying of stuff.
Do you think that there is a new normal then, or is it just an ongoing evolution and process that kind of changes depending on what bit of the
I think yeah what part of, I think yeah. part of the treatment and part of the recovery depending where you're at. I know with my family members who have been ill, like my mum and like other people that I know, I've got a friend, I've told you before, who had bowel cancer at 30 and she's now 5 or 6 years down the line, and she's like, it does get better. You do start to have your new routines, your new way of life, you fall into the sink of your body. But it takes time.
Yeah.
It does take time. I just think we're all quite accepting in this room of the fact that a cancer diagnosis changes you and your life. And the sooner you accept that and go, okay, I'm going to flow with this rather than fight the tide, it's a bit of an easier journey.
When you were first diagnosed, and maybe people listening who are newly diagnosed, I was, because I'm kind of like head down, get through it, my attitude, because it was originally thought that it maybe wasn't metastasized, was, right, just going to bury myself for 6 months.
Yeah, agreed.
Like, head down, get through the treatment, and then life is going to carry on as per usual, to the point that I literally was already, I was looking at my teaching timetable, and I was already talking about meetings that I was going to just pop back in to when my recovery, you know, don't worry about chemo, it will all be fine. And then I got into remission and I was thinking, I still want to keep my hand in occasionally with teaching, and eventually maybe in the future I want to go back to it, I just don't know. And then suddenly my cancer came back and I was like, hang on a moment, Deborah, I need to draw a line here. And actually accept that I'm really enjoying what I'm doing with my new life, my post-cancer life. And I haven't really stopped to recognise all the different things I'm doing as a result of cancer, and how actually this is now my life. So when somebody used to say, you know, when you meet someone and they're like, what do you do? And I used to go, I'm a teacher. Right. Yeah. End of conversation. Really easy. Yeah, it's fine. And now it's like, what do you do? Well, you see, I was a teacher, got cancer.
And now then, I do this, isn't this?
Yeah. And you end up kind of explaining and justifying what you do. And I'm really proud of what we do together, yeah, and all our different offshoots of the different things that we do. But it's actually accepting that is me.
That is your life now.
That is my life.
What about you, Rach? Like, for you, because obviously, like, I consider myself, my new normal is this and going to bed at night. And obviously, your normal at present is you must have a lot going up in your noggin.
Yeah.
And it's like, rather than it's stuff that you maybe think about every now and then, like dying, I'm not going to say passing away, yeah, like you think about before that happened. And now that must be something that you have to deal with every day. And is that now your new normal, that you have to deal with that emotion every single day?
Yeah, yeah. And the way I deal with it is by not thinking about it too deeply. Yeah. Because I think if you kind of go down the rabbit hole too often, you're going to get stuck there, yeah, at the bottom, and it's not a nice place to be thinking those things. So I don't, you know, I know the situation that I'm in, yeah, and I know that I'm probably not going to be living for very much longer, but I don't think about that too deeply every day, because, you know, I've said this before, I wouldn't be able to look at Freddie without weeping, yeah, all over him. And he, yeah, you know, I want to spend valuable time with him, whatever time I've got left. I want it to be good time. And, you know, the same with Steve. If I was crying all over him every day, it would maybe be making it much harder for him. And we wouldn't be having nice times
together. And you wouldn't be
together.
Making memories.
Yeah. And so that, yeah, hashtag making memories.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what we're trying to do. But that's, yeah, not to say that there aren't nights where we kind of look each other in the eye and have a good old cry, yeah, about it and just, you know.
Well,
say,
you're now an author. That's your new normal.
Yeah, well,
because that's a positive thing, isn't it?
Yes, I'm sort of 63,000 words into my memoir for Freddie. That's been a great distraction.
I think you should call it memoirs. You can take it from my blog. The memoirs.
Oh yes, the memoirs. Yeah. So that's been a really good distraction, right, to be writing that book. I'm writing down his life, my life, all the stories that I would have told him through the years, all the bits of advice that I would have given him through the years, and, you know, so far, rather than being a difficult experience to write, it's actually been really a pleasure to write and feel like, you know, I'm leaving this stuff behind for him. And then I had these thoughts the other day of, I want to leave, I think it might have been a book that I read or a film that I watched where, you know, the pair, there's always one dead parent in every book that I seem to choose at the moment. And this person had left a present for their child to open each year on their birthday. So I've kind of got this list that I put together. I picked up one of my notebooks. It was to find some Yumi Big C stuff.
Okay.
And when I looked at the notebook, I thought, oh, there's all my writing and all my, you know, scribbled notes when I do drive time, when I do drive on Five Live. And I thought, just for him, just to see my handwriting,
yeah,
scribbled down in a notebook, you know, a pile of notebooks for him one year, I think would be, that's, you know, so, an amazing, awesome, gift to open. And things like, you know, all the press clippings from everything that we've done for this. I'm going to get my sister-in-law, because people keep saying, what can I do? Yeah. I'm like, right, you're on scrapbook.
Duty, yeah.
Everyone at work, you're on getting some sort of, like, you know, demo tape together so you can hear all my radio work and, you know, stuff that's been on TV. So it's about kind of thinking through. But that's comforting to me. Mm, that's, yeah, like, you know, dotting the I's and crossing the T's before I go. And another friend here said to me the other day, who came to see me in hospital when I was having my lungs drained, yeah, where there were a lot sicker people than me. She said to me, mate, you're not there yet. You know, I'm still here. I'm still at work. We're still broadcasting. Yeah. I'm not right at that end point yet. And, you know, I am clinging on, yeah, by my fingertips.
We're pulling you, like,
yeah,
come on,
yeah,
come
you're
on,
dragging me, yeah, along. Come on, for, you know, for as long as I possibly, yeah, can.
Well, you're striding, not clinging.
Yeah. And trying not to, yeah, think about the bad stuff until we absolutely have to.
I think, is that something that we all feel is like a new normal, that we kind of, like, I think everyone worries, don't they, about the future beforehand. I think now we're all very aware of what can happen because it's happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
But rather than sitting and dwelling and worrying about it, we literally go, okay, I'm acknowledging I feel that way, but guess what? I'm going to do this and I'm going
to,
yeah, do this.
It, I think, almost spurs, yeah, you on to do great things.
I think it's a tailwind.
Yeah.
I think it's a tailwind.
I've done things that I never thought I could do. I'm dyslexic, and like Rach, I've just written a book. I'm not saying dyslexia stops you, but I do find, yeah, I write weekly. Like, this sounds really random, but I never thought I was a writer. I mean, I was okay at school, but English was not my strong point.
But you are a brilliant writer.
Yeah,
your poems are great, beautifully, yeah, written.
But it's so funny, isn't it? When you suddenly have something to write about, you suddenly then start writing.
You find your voice.
Yeah. You find, yeah, your voice. Then, like Rachel, I've written a book.
But I never, ever, ever thought, if somebody said to me, like, at the age of 15, oh, you'll write a book, I'll be like, I'll be the last person no, that will write a book. Like, seriously. And it's amazing the opportunities that you, because I think, Lauren, it's your phrase, isn't it? And I know that there's going to be a beep coming up from what I'm going to say. It's rather than a bucket list, it's a list.
Yeah. You can guess behind the beep what was there. Yeah. It began with an F, everybody.
It began with an F.
But I really like that attitude because I'm petrified of flying, and I think I've talked about this before on a podcast, but I thought, right, you know what? I don't let it stop me do anything, but I actually flew a plane myself the other day.
Just a terrifying thought, isn't it?
Yeah, and I'm so petrified. I mean, I've been rugby tackled to the ground before on a flight.
Like bridesmaids,
because I tried to bolt it off on takeoff, which was not good. Yeah. However, I keep on rationalising to myself, you know what, love? You're more likely to die of your cancer than you are in this plane. So get over it.
And it just, I think it makes you, I don't know, I feel like my new normal is that I don't, like I said, like I'm not waiting to do something. It's like now I'm like, okay, I want to go on holiday, I'm booking the flight. Yeah, I've always wanted to learn martial arts, I've just booked a karate class. I think we all go, one day I would like to. Yeah. And I think new normal for a lot of people, well, some people maybe not actually, because I think it's a choice you make. I've decided that I could live in fear now, or I could be sitting at home like boo-hooing and being like, my joints hurt and I've got a really dry vagina and I'm sweating every 5 minutes. Or I could be like, yeah, I have. So I'm going to go buy some lube and I'm going to crack on with my day and I'm going to do like things that make me happy.
Yeah, it's a different mindset, isn't it?
It's a different mindset.
For me, I kind of feel like cancer has given me my specialist subject, and that's what's kind of helped me in my career been diagnosed with cancer, because suddenly I've got something that I can wax lyrical about, that I feel like I, you know all the details about, that I can talk confidently about. And, you know, if it hadn't ended up the way that it's ended up, it actually would have been a really good thing career-wise, and it pushed me broad in that.
I love teaching, but I really love broadcasting, and I keep on thinking, oh, please don't die, please don't die.
Yeah,
I keep on thinking, I need to be around long enough to get on Strictly Come Dancing.
We are making that happen.
This is Deb's bid for Strictly. Strictly producers, if you're watching, they might have cast this year. If you need a standby, Deb's looks great in sequins. Wears a lot of them. She poses like a pro, so she must be able to dance like a pro.
Basically, I just want the outfits.
Yes, you do. I could just imagine you being like, la-da.
But I love what I'm doing. I'm not saying I didn't like what I was doing before, but I don't know whether I would ever have done this. I genuinely now keep on thinking, oh, because so it kind of drives you to try to do everything as quickly as you can.
Like Jiggy's away in her chair here, excited.
I'm like, come on, I want to do more things, right? But one step at a time.
Do you guys find that people who obviously haven't had cancer, like people around you, friends and family, who maybe haven't been around the cancer, it's like their first experience of, I get a lot of people going, you're doing too much. You're too busy. And I'm like, but I still live like I'm on borrowed time. So like, you know, when you get told you have cancer and you're in treatment, even though you're knackered and you're at the end of your cycle, you make yourself go out and do things because you're like, I might not be able to do that again. Or this is my last festival? Or like, do you know what I mean? And I don't know if that ever leaves you. I don't think it's going to leave me. I feel like I'm always going to be on borrowed time. So I'm always going to be trying to do the most.
Yeah. Debs, has it affected the way that you treat your children at all? Because I've found that knowing that I'm on my way, I spoil Freddie something rotten now. That boy is going to grow up thinking that all toys are just whatever he asks for, he will get. One day, Mummy, I want a blue crane and a bulldozer. So those are the things I order. I have to search the whole of Amazon to try and find exactly what he wants, get it for him. He literally only has to mention the word or something, or say toy shop. We go to the toy shop and get a toy. And we will take him every day to the toy shop and buy him things. And I think, oh, am I spoiling him for Steve's problem.
Yeah, exactly. You have to deal with it.
I think I've talked very honestly before about how my mind was totally focused on my career. You know, I'm quite an ambitious person. I'm not going to make apologies for that. I'm a driven person. I like to do well in whatever I do. But sometimes that is at the expense of my relationships. And I will hold my hands up to admitting that my drive for kind of, you know, an all-consuming career meant that I shut the doors a lot to my relationships with my children and my husband. And I never did the mum thing. You know, I was desperate to get back to work and didn't really do maternity leave. And then suddenly, so the longest I have ever been at home, so to speak, in whatever capacity that is. So what I mean by that is not doing a full-time job where I'm out 16 hours a day, was when I got cancer. And so I was forced by, you know, by my situation to suddenly become a mum again, or learn how to become a mum 10 years down the line. I'm not great at it still. I still have to have gin and tonic and wine.
No, that's the best form.
Which
of
is
mumming.
The best form. Yeah. But what I've realised is actually being there. It doesn't mean you have to be at every assembly. God, no one wants to do that. But just in, it's just being there and having a conversation, whether that is, and being present in those conversations. Yeah. Because I was always too busy. I was too busy answering emails to be present for the 10 minutes that my children needed me. And I'm learning now to be present for them.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know. They say sometimes that cancer is a really good thing that's happened to me. Yes, they don't want me to die, but they're like, but mummy, when you get better from cancer, are you going to go back to teaching? Mm. And I'm like, no, I'm going to carry on writing and carry on broadcasting. And they're like, oh, that's so good.
Oh, I love
it. See more of mummy.
Because they see more of me. It's nothing to do with the teaching. It's just because they want me around.
And you know your column obviously called Things Cancer Made Me Say.
Yeah.
Do you guys find that, like you said, with relationships, the way you confront things or things that annoy you or like the way you interact with people, has that changed?
Yeah, I would say it has. I was always very much a yes person before, and I found it really hard to say no to things. Whereas now I'm kind of, when I'm exhausted, I just say, like, I'm sorry, yeah, I can't make that dinner or that social engagement. And before that would have given me real anxiety that people thought I was letting them down. Whereas now I'm just like, no, you can't do everything. And like, you know, particularly on sort of social media and emails, I would try and answer everybody that sent me a message. Well, it's just impossible to do that now. So I have to like keep that low level anxiety of like, sorry, everyone, that I've not replied. But I'd just be sat there all day just typing out messages on my computer.
Rather than beat yourself up and say, oh, I can't. You're like, you're comfortable going, I can't, and I'm not going to.
Sometimes I need a bit of rest time and a bit of me time, and I can't do everything.
I have more confidence in my own ability to do things. So I think I was always like working my socks off to just impress, and I don't really know what I was trying to impress or who.
I think you're a people pleaser.
I think I occasionally am a people pleaser.
I think we're all three of us come from the same mindset, that we have the same people pleasing. We
don't
have
let anyone down.
Anxieties.
Yeah, a really hard work ethic. Yeah. So I'm like a grafter. Mm. Like I like to get my head down and do really like hard work. But what I fail to recognise is that actually sometimes you can achieve just as much by saying, no, I'm not available right now, but I'm going to be available at this time. And actually, you know what? The outcome's still going to be the same.
Yeah.
But cancer's given me a confidence in my own ability and my own self-worth in a way.
Yeah.
And I can't describe it beyond that in terms of kind of saying, no, you know what, Debs, actually, you're okay at some stuff and you can bring things to the table. So let people work with you on that rather than just always being like,
I think as a species, that's human nature. I think we beat ourselves up so much about the way we are, the way we dress, like the way we treat our bodies, how good we are at work, how good we are as friends. We can never be enough of something.
Yeah.
And then
modern society, isn't it? That there's too many balls to juggle.
Too many plates to spin, and like social media does it as well. And I definitely agree, like, with you guys in that one. Like I 100% my self-worth has gone so high. Like, not like arrogantly. I'm not walking around like peacocking like, yes, this is me, Lauren Mahn, Girl versus Cancer podcast. No, hello.
It's good for you to know your own worth.
Exactly. Because I never, especially in relationships, like, especially with boys.
Relationships, right?
Yeah. Like, I would always be like, oh, what if they don't like me? And I'm like, don't like me, don't care. And I mean it.
Yeah.
I mean it. I'm like, if you don't like me, I honestly don't care. I've got better things to do. I've got more better things to spend my energy on than worrying about what you think of me.
Yeah.
And that's been quite a nice thing, actually, because I used to carry a lot. I'm a Taurian, so, like, I'm quite stubborn. But, like, I'm like, I eat inside. So if something upsets me, I never used to say it. I just kind of go to my mates and go, something that's really annoying me.
It
would fester, but I don't anymore. I kind of just say it. Like,
and you still have to kind of live your life through your new normal, don't you? You were telling us the other day about someone who had messaged you about drinking.
Oh, my God. Yeah. The thing is, that is part of my new normal. I think now, or for a while yet, I am always relaxing and having fun and having drinks with friends. I will never not wake up the next day and think I shouldn't have done that, yeah. Even if I'm not hungover. Deb and I had two cocktails last night, and this morning I woke up, I was like, I've drank again. Yeah. And because I can't help it. But I had someone message me and say, I'm seeing that you're drinking, and I think it's amazing because I just can't do that.
Yeah,
like, I just can't do it to my body. I'm so scared it's going to come back.
Yeah.
But I'm a bit like, when my cancer's going to come back, I want to have had a really good time.
Do you know, yeah. I'm laughing because you woke up going, oh, I'm drinking again. I woke up going, well, I only had to cover the cocktail.
Yeah. I feel fine.
It was just the two. We were so proud. Actually.
I was so proud of myself.
I'm surprised.
I was like, no hungover. I have to congratulate myself for that one.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, for me, there was this stage that I went through when the cancer first came back and metastasized, and we thought it had gone to the liver. And I spoke to my secondary breast care nurse at the Christie, Bethan, who's lovely, and said to her, I'm actually scared now just to take a couple of paracetamol because I'm scared of the effect that it's going to have on
your
liver. And she said to me, you know, please don't be scared. Even our patients with very advanced liver metastases and liver cancers can still take pain medication and be on top of it. But it's just those little things that you think, oh, you know, that scares me. Should I take the paracetamol? Should I eat the kale?
But it's the guilt, because I think, and we've talked about this on other podcasts, is that sometimes when you have a cancer that you are trying your hardest to get rid of and it's not really getting the message, you suddenly start questioning everything that you're doing in your life. Yeah. And actually, the reality is that you've done nothing wrong. Yeah. And it's recognising that you've just got one of those cancers that, unfortunately, there's not really much you can do about it.
Didn't your prof say something really good to you about this?
So my recurrence happened, as we know, a month ago now. But I was really gutted because we always knew it was coming back. Mm. And we always knew that was the case, but it came back a lot sooner than I thought. And the reason I was so gutted is because I'd spent like the 6 weeks between my scans, or the 3 months between my scans, exercising. I was running 10Ks. I was really kind of doing everything, minus the odd glass of wine. I was doing everything that people would advocate you doing.
Yeah, the healthy living lifestyle.
Yeah, those people that are waxing lyrical over, this cured my cancer.
Yeah.
I was doing that and my cancer still came back, and I remember getting incredibly upset about it. And my oncologist said, Deborah, don't get into that game with yourself. He said, don't try to think you can cure your cancer. You've done nothing wrong. And I think it's accepting that and then saying, OK, fine, I'm a little bit at the mercy of my team and luck.
Yeah, because if your cancer is going to metastasize, there's a whole load of processes going on within your body that means it's going to metastasize. So, you know, I've just been getting floods of emails from people when this has all gone very public that I'm terminally ill, saying, oh, eat this healthy diet and take this and that. And I'm just like, look, eating some broccoli is not going to shrink the 7 centimetre tumour in my liver. And you can tell me all about the keto diet and all of these healthy things that I can do. They ain't getting rid of this cancer.
This is the thing. It's like, you know, you're like, your new normal might be, oh, okay, I'm like now a vegan, or I'm eating really like I've cut out meat, or I'm doing all those things. And that's great, because that's just great for your general health.
And well-being.
And that's a good thing. And it actually does help support. So, like, alongside medicines, having a nice healthy
diet. Complementary
treatments. So, like, having really, like, a really healthy diet and, like, taking on loads of water and exercising alongside your medicine is better for you.
Well, it helps you
get through it more easily,
exactly,
doesn't it?
Exactly. But you can't sit there to someone and say, I'll eat this, it will cure you, because that's not the case. If this cancer's coming back, it's coming back.
Yeah, but it's so easy, right? So I'm somebody who is always batting away all of that. And I found myself, since the cancer's come back, and I know Rachel's in this position as well, where I'm a bit of a researcher, you know, that I bring my random love my stats.
Yeah.
But I've started really reading again about kind of things that I might be able to do. But it's quite a dangerous hole to go down into. And then I start reading behind the headlines. So I might jump onto a person who's like, I've cured my cancer. And then I get really angry about it, because what I realise
I do the same cycle.
Yeah, you do the same cycle. It's that actually the green juices hasn't cured his cancer. It was the operation that he had.
Somewhere in the story hidden away will always be that line of they have had some sort of conventional treatment which probably has cured their cancer, yet, you know, it's the confirmation bias. So, well, I started taking the cannabis oil or I changed my diet and that is what did it. So, yeah, it's, and I get down that same hole and it makes me angry. So I think
the new norm is accepting that for some people, accepting that you've done nothing wrong with your cancer and that burden that you carry alongside your cancer.
And a lot of people, new normal is a massive lifestyle change.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? People like who have had bowel like issues or cancers, they have to change. Some people have to change their whole diets.
Well, they might
Some people have a bag. So it can be a very physical thing, and it means that they have to change the way that they live.
But also, Loz, with you, sorry to interrupt.
No,
it's all right. I was literally just thinking with you, one of a big change for you is fertility.
Yeah.
Right. So you've come to the table where you now have to go through, well, you don't have to do anything, but should you want to have children, you're going to have a whole new mindset in your new normal. Like pre-cancer Loz would have just maybe had a one night. No, you wouldn't have had a one night stand. You know, you would have found a lovely guy.
Got married.
And had, but you maybe wouldn't have thought about having to conceive. Whereas your new normal now
is it's going to have to be calculated. Yeah. And even to the point where I know I can carry children and have children, but my risk of recurrence will obviously greatly increase by releasing these hormones back into my body and having IVF.
9 months are going to be tense.
And I'm that my new normal is now, do I want to do that? And then I have to look at surrogacy and things like that. So yeah, it is a new normal, and it's like okay, yeah, I have that's you're really right. I didn't even think about that being my new normal actually, but yeah, it is. And even the fact of this is a new normal. So obviously, being in menopause, I sit and watch TV like everyone, and I can always come on a tampon advert, and I actually have sat there and been a bit like, Oh, never gonna have to buy those again. And it's weird, and it's not like people go, oh, it'd be nice not having a period. It's like, yeah, but we're not this early in my life.
When it's enforced on you and you don't have a choice.
Yeah, so it's like, yes, like, great, I don't have to buy these things and wear these annoying pads anymore. But it's also a weird thing to sit there and go, Jesus, that is not in my life.
Yeah. My new normal is I have to pee. I like I might actually have to wee in the middle of the
if you leg it, then yeah, we'll know where you've gone. it seems like an opportune moment to bring in our guest today, Liz O'Riordan, who is a consultant breast surgeon. And she's totally had to get used to a new normal. In 2015, she was diagnosed with stage 3 breast cancer at the age of 40. She blogged about it at the time. She now gives talks about it and has written a book, The Complete Guide to Breast Cancer, which is full of all the tips and tricks that she's learnt along the way. Hiya, Liz.
Hi, Liz. Hi, ladies. How are you?
What a pleasure to have you on the podcast at last.
I'm so excited to be here.
Yeah. I mean, I should say, I've spoken to you so much on Twitter and on the telephone, Liz. You've been such an amazing support to me through the sort of various stages of my treatment that I've been through, that when there's been a bit of a confusing situation, you've just said, call me, I'll explain this to you, and you do. So, yeah, thank you for being a friend and a mentor, Liz.
You're welcome.
We've been talking about the new normal there. What does your new normal look like?
Well, part of me still thinks I've never had cancer.
Yeah.
It's this weird kind of denial. I was so young and fit and healthy before I got cancer, and everyone says, you look so well. And it's really hard to think that you actually have had cancer, your lifestyle's changed. For me, one of the biggest things, again, hearing you talk about the menopause, was, you know, you wake up in the night thinking you've wet yourself because you're having a hot flush and the infertility. And losing hair and having to almost redefine who I am as a woman. Mm-hmm. And coming to terms with the body changes. And then my cancer came back in May. So I had an implant in, but that's gone out. And I had a recurrence in my armpit. And I'm now getting used to life as a uniboober.
Yeah. Welcome to the uniboob gang, Liz.
Yes. And it was suddenly, what do you wear? And I realised you wear whatever the hell you like, because who cares if people are looking, but it's really hard to get used to dressing yourself differently.
Yeah, I go with a lot of high-necked tops now.
I just
Nothing
think
too plunging.
I'm wearing low-cut tops and I just don't care if people want to stare. It's a bit like cancer isn't a dirty secret and I shouldn't be ashamed of it, and everybody's lopsided, so what?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you get home and you undress and look in the mirror and have a cry at what you do look like, really. But that's been really hard to come to terms with.
Yeah. How difficult has it been going back to work for you after all you've been through? Because, you know, this is your day-to-day job, yeah. is yeah. dealing with the people who are dealing with what you'd been dealing with for the last few years.
It was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. So I had 18 months of work in total, so 9 months of treatment, chemo, surgery, radiotherapy, and then about 6 months to get my energy back. And I went back to a different hospital where I could shadow consultants working before I was thrown in the deep end.
Yeah.
And the first time I saw a woman find out that she had cancer, and you see the stiff upper lip and they kind of sag and then pull themselves back together, I just wanted to give her a hug.
Yeah.
I knew exactly what she was going through, and I wanted to say, yes, this is shit, it's terrible, I get where you're coming from. And the doctors were saying, no, don't say that, you've got to be really positive.
Yeah.
And I just want to be their friend and tell them chemo isn't that bad, I can help.
Yeah.
But
do you tell them you've had cancer, Liz?
Sorry?
Do you tell them that you've had cancer?
That was a really hard one. I think it's a bit like when you have cancer, everyone comes and tells you, oh, my aunt had this and she died, and
yeah.
my sister had this and she was
oh,
fine.
Yeah.
And I think, although I hate the journey word,
yeah.
you have
yeah.
to go through it yourself.
Yeah,
and
it.
I can't influence them.
Mm.
I was very active and sporty. I did a small sprint try during chemo. And if my patients read that and think, well, Luminex, she did that and I can't get out of bed, I don't want to guilt them.
Yeah.
But it's when I've been seeing patients at a year follow-up and I ask them about tamoxifen and how bad does it make you feel in the menopause, and it's then I'm saying, I actually do know what it's like because I've been through it, I can help.
Yeah, you can empathize.
And I do talk about sex and relationships because nobody talks about it.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
that's when I think I can make a difference, when that time has passed. But it's been really, really hard because
yeah.
you're reminded of it every single day.
Yeah, because there are very few people who would be in your position who have that level of knowledge that you have.
Yeah.
But it was about your own illness. And do you think, knowing that, you know, everyone says, oh, stay away from Dr. Google.
It's the first thing I did.
Yeah. Do you think it makes it harder to deal with?
Yeah, I think, although I thought I knew everything there was to know about breast cancer, I realised I had no idea what it's like to actually have chemotherapy. So I'm sure you've talked about this. I didn't realise you lost all your body hair.
Yeah.
Someone told me your pubes will fall out first, and
yeah.
I went, what?
Yeah, you were the one that told me
yeah.
that, so it came as less
thought,
of a shock.
I'm a doctor, I should know this. I never realised what position your arms go in for radiotherapy, and it was... Well, the doctors tell you what's going to happen. It's patients that tell you how to cope.
Yeah, because the doctors just don't
and
know.
And I was desperate for information. I wanted to wallow and see how bad it could be.
Yeah, and you really wallowed, didn't you? Because you told me that you'd put all of your stats into that kind of doctor's prognosis computer system.
But I've actually realised there's a part of you, I think, whenever anyone gets really bad news, you want to know how bad it's going to be. You want to prepare yourself. And it's at 3 o'clock in the morning, hiding under the duvet, so your husband doesn't see. And then I realised stats are irrelevant because it either comes back or it doesn't.
Yeah, and the stats, like
yeah.
we said that before, you know, the stats
yeah.
don't define you and your they're just, you know, pinpoints of different people's experiences all
exactly.
plotted out on a map.
If you're in the 90% or the 10%, you don't know until you either die without cancer or it comes back. And it's good to try and not worry about the stats, but at the back of your mind, when you get a setback, it's very tempting to go, let me just see what my odds are now.
How is it for you now, Liz? Because obviously, as someone who's been, like, I'm currently all clear.
Yeah.
You were in, that situation. And then so you have that fear of recurrence and then it happens. So how has that kind of affected you? And has that changed again your mindset?
It was kind of disbelief again. I thought I might have had bone mets because I'd had some weird hip pain at night.
Oh, girl,
and I was
preach.
Doing too
yeah.
much running and stuff. And I'd had a lump for a year that I just thought was knotty scar tissue. No one thought it was a recurrence. And because I'm treated in a hospital where my husband works or I'd worked, you get that look when you're in the waiting room and you kind of think, no one's catching my eye. Is this good? Is this bad?
Yeah.
And I think it was just so hard realising it's come back. It's not meant to come back. It's come back. What does it mean?
Yeah, this wasn't in the plan. Yeah.
No, and you just can't get your head around it.
Yeah.
And you almost feel a bit like you're a cat with nine lives.
Hi, Liz. I know exactly where you were. That happened to me a month ago. And
yeah.
you're like, what? I've just got to remission. This
yeah.
is my ultimate dream. And then 3 months later.
I know.
But I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, that you've, it could be nomograms that you've used, but you've put your stats into a computer system.
Yeah.
Is it like the Sloan Kettering nomogram one?
A little bit like it.
A little bit like it, to give you a prognosis. Now,
yeah.
I did that and I did that before it had metastasized. But what were your feelings? Why did you do that? And has it helped you accept your diagnosis?
Kind of yes and no. So we, whenever anybody gets a breast cancer diagnosis, we use this computer model to predict their benefit of chemotherapy to help decide whether we give it or not.
Yep.
So we do it for everybody.
Okay.
So I knew I was going to have mine to see. We give the benefit, we give chemo if there's a benefit of more than 5%, and my benefit was 13%, so I knew I'd have it.
Wow.
But it then tells you what your stats of being alive in 5 or 10 years are, and I often use that to help patients decide if they're really struggling with tamoxifen and the menopause symptoms. If it's only a very small benefit, then they may say, actually, I've tried it for 2 years, I'll stop.
That's so
and you kind of wallow thinking,
me.
Shit, this is really, really bad. But again, it's like, well, it might not happen.
Yeah, no, I actually found a lot of comfort in those statistics because really? I think I did.
It was handy knowing.
It was really handy knowing. And I appreciate it's different when it's metastasized for bowel cancer. I'm not sure about breast. But I was actually looking at the published stats.
Yeah.
And I recognised that when I put it in, well, not me, I did it alongside Professor Cunningham. When we put it into the system, actually, my chances were much higher.
Yeah.
Do you think that, is that common for most patients that you see?
I think so. And I think patients just want that information and they want to know kind of what their chances are. And I think it helps a lot of them almost think differently, live differently, try and be a bit more healthy. Again, it's a bit like having a second chance.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm the only person in the room who hasn't done it.
No, me too. I was too scared of hearing, a time frame or a number or a figure that would stick in my head.
That's exactly.
So it's the same now. You know, I will not ask the doctors. People keep asking me, "Oh, how long have they told you you've got?" Well, doctors won't tell you.
No, we can't
unless you ask.
And if we get it wrong, we cause all sorts of chaos.
Yeah.
That's really, really hard.
And so I know that they know something, and I know it's less than a year because they've signed all the forms that the life insurance and everything is paid out. But, you know, beyond that, I do not want a figure because it's only a best guesstimate, really, isn't it? Like we've said with all of these
but
things.
But isn't it weird? Because before I got ill, I would want to know. I was like, oh, no, I want to know everything about everything. Now I'm like, ignorance is bliss.
Yes, exactly.
I don't want to know.
I have a deal with my oncologist, and I've said this before, that I only want to know when I've run out of options and it's like we're at the end of the line.
You've got a couple of weeks.
I'm like, don't tell me. I'm like, I'm batting it away already.
Crack open your bottle of £850 champagne when it's...
Oh, God, The night sweats and the hot flushes. I can't drink anymore. I just don't sleep. It's not worth it.
No. Do you know what, Liz, like just what you said then about putting in the stats into the computer and like showing people their options with tamoxifen and stuff. I literally was in that situation about 2 months ago where I'm like, I can't handle this. And it was like the low mood as well floored me. And I was like, I can't do this. And I didn't even know it was an option. And the doctor said to me, well, we can take you off of it. But then again, it was that thing of, well, what if I come off it? My cancer comes back. I will always blame myself.
Yeah, and that's the hard bit to accept.
And this is the stuff about this new lifestyle. It's like your choices you make do feel like life and death choices. It's not just, what am I having for dinner?
The problem with the new normal is I think all of us have created this amazing, not amazing is the wrong word, but taken opportunities after a cancer diagnosis.
Yes.
Look at what we're all doing.
Yeah.
And my life has just become cancer.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm the breast surgeon with breast cancer, and it's all anybody talks about, and it's all I talk about. And I think it's really hard to remember who Liz was before all of this happened.
Oh, my God, yeah.
I mean, you are very much an honorary UMI Big C member, Liz, because you're the same mindset of all of us, and you're very passionate about flagging up misinformation on social media, and particularly and things that come up in the press about cancer and its causes, which is something that we always get really annoyed about. And I think that's a great thing that you do on Twitter.
And it's partly one of the reasons why we wrote the book. I realised it was hard for me going on forums, which I think give a lot of people amazing
support.
Yeah,
stay away from the forums, scary places.
As a doctor, you kind of want to correct patients when they're wrong, and then they know you're a doctor, and suddenly you're the doctor for the forum.
But everyone's asking you questions.
And then Facebook is just full of cancer and you kind of want a cancer-free space. But you read patients saying, is it safe to go out in public during radiotherapy? Mm. And can I have sex with my husband during chemo because I'm scared I'll intoxicate him?
Yeah. And there's so many misconceptions, aren't there?
Exactly. And again, with the diet that you were talking about, there's no evidence that diet can cure your cancer or bring it back. And that's of why
Thank
we wrote
you,
that
doctor.
Book to say, this is all bollocks.
Yeah.
Actually.
Yeah. Yes. I am. It's so... I'm. It, it's actually emotional hearing you say that, because I've just written something recently. We all write about this consistently, where we've just talked about it. We get sent, we're bombarded with things saying, have you tried this?
Yeah. And the vitamin C enemas and the kale juicing.
And I went to Cancer Research. I work closely with Cancer Research UK, and I got their, you know this.
Yeah.
And there isn't actually evidence. And it's absolutely diet, exercise.
Live a healthy lifestyle.
For you, and make yourself feel good.
Like, I think it's getting a sense of control and a sense of hope.
Yes. Mm.
And I understand that, but I get worried when people stop conventional treatment.
I do, yeah.
And spend hundreds of thousands of pounds desperately searching for hope and control. And it's a scary place when your cancer comes back.
Yes.
But then the family and the doctors have to pick up the pieces when it doesn't work.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I've just been overwhelmed with the amount of emails that I've got for different things. And it's always a bit of like a ooh moment when somebody sends me something new. I'm like, ooh, this person is saying I should drink kerosene. That's
I get emails from people telling me to tell you to try something.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
Oh, no, poor Rage has had it this week.
Yeah. Liz, I think you'll know the report I'm talking about, but there was a report out a couple of weeks ago saying that actually those that shun conventional routes and pick up alternative routes actually have a worse prognosis, don't they?
Yeah, they do. 20% higher mortality, I think.
Absolutely. And I think my understanding is it's because actually they have to go back to conventional routes in the end, but because of the delay, I think over a 9-year period, it was much more higher mortality. Is that?
And they're almost starting on third line treatment because they've bypassed first and second line.
And it's stuff like, it's getting the right information now. So is that why you've written your book?
Yeah, I mean, I'm partly... Explaining breast cancer is really quite complicated, and I realised I have 10 minutes to tell a woman, you have cancer, you need a mastectomy, would you like a reconstruction, sign here, see you in a week. And you don't take anything in when someone says you have cancer. You just want to run out that room screaming, but the doctor has to examine you. And I just thought, if I can explain the basic signs bit and then tell people how to cope and then explain why we tell you what we're doing and how to live your life and what signs to look out for recurrence, because so many people don't know their cancer can come back.
Yeah. Has it made you a better doctor?
Yes. I'd like to say no and think I was pretty good to start with, but it's definitely changed the language I use. Yeah. So, I mean, I've seen all cancers, from old ladies with a very small cancer that'll never kill them to women younger than Rachel with worse disease. And I used to tell people, you know, we're lucky we've caught it early. It's good it hasn't spread. No one's lucky to get cancer.
Yeah.
And when you're on the receiving end of every treatment, it does change what you say and how you interact with people. But I've had to learn not to be their friend. I want to be the breast care nurse and give them a hug and give them this advice. And I'd have to be the one to say, I'm sorry, it's spread, you need chemo. And that's been really hard for me. Yeah. Just to step back and try and just find that boundary
slightly.
Again.
Because, I mean, you know, you are always giving advice online to people like me and loads of other people with cancer. Where do you find the energy to do that and to kind of keep going and helping people as well as doing your job and all the other amazing things that you do?
I honestly don't know. I have no idea where this inner strength came from. If you told me 4 years ago that I'd be doing this, I'd said you're crazy. Yeah. I just think when I was signed off work with cancer for 2 years, I lost my purpose because all I ever wanted to do was help people. And I was looking at 2 years at home on the sofa. Mm. And the blogging and the writing was just a way of almost carrying on feeling needed.
I totally agree. I went into depression, not mainly because of, well, partly because of cancer, but partly because I went from a career that I loved to working in an atmosphere where you would go in and you feel part of a community.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. And all that was taken away from me because of cancer.
Yeah.
And I felt pointless. I was a teacher who had like a vocation in life.
I get that completely.
And then I had to rebuild myself to do something else that I feel passionate about. And like you find a new vocation.
And it feels like even though you've had this recurrence that you've had to deal with, you know, just from following your pictures, you're still living a life, your new normal, you're doing your cycling, you know, you're super, super fit, aren't you? And really into fitness.
I set up a website called cancerfit.me with my own triathlon coach, Tanya Slater, who coached her dad through pancreatic cancer to ride at Mont Ventoux.
Wow.
And
wow.
Lucy Gossage, who's an oncologist and the UK's top female long distance triathlete.
Yeah.
and another breast cancer patient called Jill Fullan, who came back fitter and faster and is winning age group triathlons all over the world. Because there's no evidence telling patients with cancer to train. Most doctors say what they think they should, but there's no evidence. And I was told, don't run for 3 months and don't swim, and it's just rubbish. And there's so much evidence now to show that you can do so much more. And for me, exercise is my mindfulness. I think I'm lucky to have two arms and two legs that work, and it's almost a second chance. And just getting out on a bike or swimming, it's like, I'm alive, I can do this.
Exactly. I was saying this earlier, that's why I run, albeit very slowly, but it's a sense of achievement. In comparison to me, I bet you're not.
But I can't walk up a flight of stairs, but I'm way slower than both of you.
It's a sense of freedom, isn't it? And I think my understanding is actually the guideline, well, you're the doctor, but my understanding is the guidelines for exercise is almost the same as actually, I mean, obviously if you've just had surgery and stuff, you have to be careful. But am I correct in thinking it's almost similar to actually a normal person, which is five times a week, 30 minutes a week, 30 minutes a day,
getting
or something
your heart
like
rate up and sweaty. I mean, in Denmark now, people having chemo are given their own PT, their own physio. They do HIIT training in the gym and lift weights.
Wow!
There's no reason why you can't.
That's amazing. And is it because of the link in terms of reducing kind of anxiety and depression, or is also that it helps people recover quicker from operations and things like that?
That's a huge part of it, the mental side, but also it stops you reducing your muscle mass, it stops you wasting away. And they're now looking at gym programs as almost prehab. So people with esophageal and colorectal cancer.
Yes, they've done a program at the Marsden on that one, haven't they?
Yeah, they're getting them in the gym beforehand because it means they get better from the operation quicker and they cope with chemo quicker.
Oh, I mean, this is the problem that I've been noticing it over the last few weeks, and particularly yesterday, is that my leg muscles are really wasting away at the moment. Suddenly, so I got changed to do some filming in the toilets at the bar across the road yesterday, put on a lovely pair of new heels that I was wearing. I'd crouched down to put something in my bag, and then was crouched down and thought, I don't think that I can get up from here.
I remember
from
you
this
going,
sitting position. I was like, how do I deal with this whilst locked in a toilet by myself? And I the sink is just there.
You can't take the shoes off.
Exactly. Well, I would have had to have sat down on the floor in my new jumpsuit. So I couldn't have done that.
No.
So I had to use the sink to pull myself up. And then I've really noticed, I used to do a big step up onto the bath because my husband is super tall. He's always got the shower up really high, the shower head. So I always pull it down. And I can't make that step up onto the side of the bath anymore. I'm just like an old woman going, and it just can't, I can't quite make it. So it can happen really quickly
because
about 2 months ago, I was still out running and would be doing just a little couple of miles run around the fields by where we live.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden, you know, I can't walk up a flight of stairs and my muscles are wasted away in my legs. That I can't even get up from a crouched position. So, you know, I think the fitter you are and the fitter you keep yourself for as long as possible, you can kind of fend off that
I'd
for
love
longer.
To. I'm going to find out more about, what's the website again?
So it's www.cancerfit.me.
Okay. And is it for all, like, because I am absolutely passionate about this, but I'm never going to do a triathlon. So is it
Can you doggy paddle?
Oh, I'm rubbish.
But if you can doggy paddle and ride a push bike and walk, you could do a sprint triathlon.
I like to do the bobbin bike. I have one of those pink ones
that
I cycle around with
my... You don't need a flash bike.
That would be brilliant. I would love to do that.
With my dog in the basket.
Yeah. I would come and watch that triathlon.
So I hate the colour pink, but I do it in a pink tutu and a pink neon wig, anything I'm doing, just because. The website, it's not up and running yet. It's just a holding page. We're waiting for funding, but it will be a resource for anybody.
Okay, that sounds great.
That's
Thank
brilliant.
You.
So what is next in your new normal then? It sounds like this website and the exercise side of things is going to keep you busy, but what does your next part of your new normal look like?
I finish radiotherapy on Tuesday and then I'm having my ovaries out so I can switch to letrozole.
Okay.
And then, because that puts you into an instant surgical menopause, which will be delightful.
Yeah, it sounds like fun, mate.
And I'm probably going to take a couple of months just to recover from that and then reassess things, hopefully go back to work. But it's going to be mentally really hard having had a recurrence. I need to remember I'm a patient as well.
And look after your own mental health.
Because you've just had radiotherapy today.
Yeah, I had a second round of radiotherapy to the same area. So I've got risk of getting lymphedema and chronic pain and arm stiffness and things. But you do what you can to keep you alive, don't you?
And I guess you will, you know, you're the best person to have assessed the pros and cons of having that.
Exactly, but it is hard.
Do you feel like, apologies if we've touched on this earlier, because you are the doctor and you are presenting the kind of expert view,
yeah.
Do you feel that you then have added pressure to be that mentally strong person?
Yes, I was going to come to this.
Okay, and how do you, because we're all kind of in a similar position where actually we present, we're honest about what it's like, yeah. But we present a positive view on how we're dealing with the rubbish.
The hair and the makeup,
yeah,
and the clothes.
How are you doing that?
Badly. I think when I first started blogging, and then you become the poster girl for, yeah, breast cancer and blogging and exercise and healthy living, and there's days where you just feel like shit and you're crying in the shower and you're eating cake and you haven't run for 3 weeks and you feel you don't want your public following to see the real you because you're meant to be this superwoman. And I think they need to see that I'm not a superwoman and that I'm really struggling, but it's hard to let the world in. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. You sort of don't want to let the people down who say how great you're doing. Yeah.
Say, oh my God, she's amazing, she's running ICANN. And you think, well, actually, sometimes it's really, really shit and I just want to lay in bed and cry.
Yeah.
And I think that's really hard.
Yeah, but it's comforting. It's comforting for me to even hear you say that.
Same.
So I'm sure it's going to be comforting for our listeners to hear.
I think social media is weird. I think, like, so when someone DMs you, you feel you need to reply instantly.
Yes, yeah.
And it's remembering these are complete strangers who you don't know. And if you don't reply for a week, that's okay if you're not in the right space.
Yeah.
I remember you saying that to me as well. Don't worry about replying to all of these messages. Don't put that extra bit of pressure on yourself.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's remembering these are strangers and you reply to some people, you won't reply to others. They won't mind. They won't hold a grudge.
Yeah.
Because you can get so involved in the whole Instagram, Twitter, Facebook reply instantly. And it's remembering that you aren't just a cancer patient. You're your own person. You need your own life. You need your own distance, where today is a day I'm not going to talk about cancer.
Yeah. And I don't know about you, but I think sometimes I'm aware, and I know that the girls here are aware, that actually if you're somebody at home and you're, say, looking at these people on social media who are out partying, and I appreciate that sometimes I portray that image, then actually if you're having a rubbish day, it can make you feel worse because you feel like a failure. You feel like the person who's not coping with cancer very well. So I think it is really important to kind of say, okay, today I'm having a glass of wine, but yesterday I was vomiting.
Yeah. I think we do need to, I mean, the podcast is great, but I think I'm learning on Twitter, I need to open up and share my bad days. But then I get my mum and my family saying, are you all right? Because I hadn't told them first. And it's
I get that too. Suddenly a text from mum pops up. Are you having issues with your breathing today? You're wearing oxygen?
Yeah. Why am I finding out second hand, third hand?
Yeah. Oh, sorry, I forgot to text everybody.
Yeah, it's a funny world, isn't it?
It is.
Well, Liz, it's been an absolute joy to have you on the podcast, finally.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Liz.
Thank you so much for being so open. And good luck with all that exercise website and everything, which sounds fabulous. And of course, good luck with the rest of your radiotherapy and your treatment.
And your book is out.
When the 27th of September.
Okay.
The Complete Guide to Breast Cancer,
27th of September. Yeah. It will be a brilliant read, I guarantee it.
Thank you, Liz.
I'll
see you all at Henley.
Yes, the festival.
Thank you.
Yeah, that'd be amazing.
My secret plan, yeah. Lots of love to you all.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Liz. It's been great to talk to you. Bye. Bye-bye. Well, thank you so much for listening today. Remember, you can always contact us. This is across all forms of social media. Use the hashtag YouMeBigC. You could also help us out by writing a review.
Yay.
Leave us a rating. And spreading the word about the podcast. We'd really appreciate it.
And share.
Thank you to everyone who has done that so far, because I know a lot of you have. So we really appreciate it. And five-star rating.
Five-star, don't forget.
We'll be back next week.
See you then. Bye.
Unfortunately, as you're all aware, Rachel will not be back next week. Rachel died in the early hours of the 5th of September. Her wish was for the podcast to continue. We will grant her that wish. We will be back. We promise you that. We still want you to talk to us using the hashtag YouMeBigC across all forms of social media. We're going to have a little break while we figure out how to do this and do our girl justice. But I promise you, once we know when we're back, you'll be the first to know. So thank you so much for continuing to listen and download, getting us to the top spot. And we're looking forward to talking to you all again soon.
Thanks for downloading the You, Me and the Big C podcasts.
Don't forget to click subscribe.
Or get more great podcasts from 5Live at bbc.co.uk/podcasts.
Cool.
Nice flow. That was fun.
I really enjoyed that.